Strap yourselves in, everybody. This is gonna be a big show. Probably too big, honestly. I don't even have time for the intro I'm about to do, but I'm gonna do it anyway. Because today on the show, we've got deportations, we've got concentration camps, we've got healthcare. Actually, we don't, but with our revolution in Texas, maybe people in Texas soon will. We've got Oklahoma, or at least half of it, because it might get cut in half in the near future. We've got Ken Klippenstein, some great reporting on ICE and the lack of reporting that ICE is doing on people who are dying in its custody. And then in the final block of the show, we're gonna have meanwhile in big news from Hong Kong, from Canada, from Sudan as well. So much to get to, so in fact, we are just going to jump into the big news of the day. Donald Trump has announced, sort of at the last minute, without any real fanfare, a massive change to immigration policy in the United States. And he did it, of course, on Twitter, tweeting, "Next week, ICE will begin the process of removing the millions of illegal aliens who have illicitly found their way into the United States." Who taught him illicitly? "They will be removed as fast as they come in. Mexico, using their strong immigration laws, is doing a very good job of stopping people long before they get to our southern border." My, how fast it changes from "they're not doing anything and they're awful" to "they're doing a great job." Guatemala is getting ready to sign a safe third agreement. "The only ones who won't do anything are the Democrats in Congress. They must vote to get rid of the loopholes and fix asylum. If so, border crisis will end quickly." So let's start with the first part of that, because there's some issues there. And in fact, in this video, I'm going to be describing five reasons that this whole thing is dumb and bad and awful, and why our time is dumb and bad and awful. But first, that he is going to take just everyone who's come across the border and begin shipping millions of them away. The first issue with that is that what he's describing is illegal. And it's not complicated to see how it's illegal. All you have to do is go to, as you probably do periodically, US Code 1158 on asylum that says, under the section authority to apply for asylum, under the subsection in general, any alien who is physically present in the United States or who arrives in the United States, whether or not at a designated port of arrival, and including an alien who is brought to the US after having been interdicted in international United States waters, irrespective of such alien status, may apply for asylum in accordance with this section or, where applicable, section 1225B. I probably didn't need to read that part, you probably knew that. So the basic idea is that you cannot simply round these people up asserting that they have no right to be here. We have asylum laws in the US. They're incredibly clear, so incredibly clear that I even understood them. And so those people are allowed to apply for asylum. Now, that is why at the end of his tweet, Donald Trump implied that asylum needs to be fixed. But asylum is not broken, and asylum is not one of these loopholes that he talks about. It is a very important international law. We have our particular version here in the US, but there's forms of it all over the world for very important reasons, because parts of the world are chaotic for economic reasons, for military reasons, pretty soon for climate reasons. And we will need a system of asylum for seekers to go through. We have that right now. You cannot simply say that those people cannot apply for asylum and we're just gonna round them up in buses and ship millions of them across the border. So, number one, it's illegal. Number two, it's kind of shooting itself in its own foot. Large-scale ICE enforcement operations are typically kept secret to avoid tipping off targets. In fact, just last year, Trump and other senior officials threatened the mayor of Oakland, California with criminal prosecution for alerting city residents that immigration raids were in the works. So if you warn one city that ICE is coming in, there's criminal prosecution. What happens if you warn an entire country? I don't know, but I'll settle for him leaving office. Illegal, shoots itself in the foot, makes it harder to actually do it because you're warning people that it's coming. Although we're gonna return in just a little bit to why he did it anyway, even though it's shooting itself in the foot. Number three, they don't have the manpower to do this or anything approaching anything like this, rounding up millions of people. In fact, ICE arrests in the US interior have been declining in recent months because so many agents are busy managing the record surge of migrant families across the southern border with Mexico, as well as the fact that even if they weren't to have to do that, they don't have the manpower, they don't have a fraction of the manpower. So it's making promises that the actual workforce of ICE can't possibly do. Now, it's possible that he has plans to bring in workers from some other aspect of the federal government, perhaps the military or the National Guard, something like that. He might do that. That's the sort of thing that historically Republicans have been really concerned about. I remember Alex Jones talking about, you know, Operation Jade Dragon or whatever it was in Texas where they had National Guard exercises, and they believed that was the beginning military law being imposed across the United States. So maybe they'll have to do that. If not, they just don't have the manpower to accomplish what Donald Trump is so casually saying that they're going to do. And in terms of it being casual, we turn to number four, the fact that apparently nobody knew about this up until that tweet. So Phil Mattingly tweeted GOP senators on if they know what President Trump is referring to with those tweets. Senator Thune said, "I have no idea. I have not heard anything, nor has anyone else that I know of heard anything about this." Senator Blunt said, "Nope." So there you have two senior Republican senators with no clue what this actually is, how it's going to be done. And by the way, although they won't go on the record, if you do just a little bit of digging, you can find anonymous ICE officials talking to reporters and saying they had never heard of this either. So the senators who might have to defend this in the legislature don't know what's going on. The ICE officials are gonna have to actually put this random tweet into policy, don't know what's going on. So that's reason number four. Donald Trump apparently thought of this, maybe in a chat with Stephen Miller, and that's all we know at this point. But number five is the big one, and it's the real story lurking behind all of this. Why announce this randomly in a couple of tweets? Why do it when it's illegal? Why do it when it's shooting itself in the foot, when you don't have the manpower to do it, when nobody knows that you were going to do it until it was announced? Well, it's because Trump is holding a rally tonight, actually, in Orlando, Florida, a key state in his reelection hopes. And more importantly, it is the formal beginning of his campaign for re-election. And that is what all of this about the deportation force is actually about. He has no idea, no more idea than I do, whether or not they could actually do this or how it would be done, how complex it would be, how expensive it would be, how much you would need the help of Republicans in the House and the Senate to defend it, whether the judges would actually allow it. All of these questions he doesn't have answers for. He only has an answer to one question: what do my supporters want to cheer for tonight in Orlando? And what they want is a ridiculous idea that he's gonna deport millions and millions of people, which is, by the way, what he said he was going to do the last time he ran for president. Now, thankfully, they haven't actually done it. Almost every aspect of immigration policy that he's touched between 2016 and now has been an absolute disaster, but so far it has not come to millions of people being deported. But that is what he's going to promise tonight in Orlando. He is going to get his followers riled up in a 2-minute hate where their xenophobia and how much they just despise people coming across the southern border will be channeled into support for Donald Trump. And that is what all of this is about. And so normally in a segment like this, I would end by saying, so it really sucks that he's apparently gonna be deporting millions of people, but in fact, I have to end with a question. Will he be deporting millions of people? Will we actually be instituting this previously unthinkable policy if he thinks it might help him get reelected? Honestly, at this point, I don't know, but I do know that he will be promising it live later tonight. Now with that, and not unrelated to that, let's turn to a related topic. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez took to Twitter over the last day to attack the apparent reality that at this point in the US, we effectively have concentration camps that are holding massive numbers of migrants, including migrant children. With her tweeting, "This administration has established concentration camps on the southern border of the United States for immigrants, where they are being brutalized with dehumanizing conditions and dying. This is not hyperbole, it is the conclusion of expert analysis." And by the way, in terms of that brutalizing, a little bit later on the show, we're gonna have Kenny Klippenstein, who's gonna talk about how ICE has been going to incredible lengths to hide how many people are actually dying in their custody. But those concentration camps are being established. We're gonna have some quotes from experts on concentration camps in just a little bit. But understand that the link has been even easier to make over the past week when it was announced that the Trump administration is going to hold migrant children at a base that served as a World War II Japanese internment camp. Now, this comes just a couple of months after they apparently were considering sending migrant children to Guantanamo Bay. That apparently wasn't a clear enough example of a resurgence of US concentration camps, and so the internment camps will be reopened there as well. Now, after she drew attention to an Esquire piece that talked to experts on genocide and concentration camps, how they're set up, the history of them in a variety of different countries across the past century, she was attacked, and so she tweeted this. "And for the shrieking Republicans who don't know the difference, concentration camps are not the same as death camps. Concentration camps are considered by experts as, quote, the mass detention of civilians without trial. And that's exactly what this administration is doing. And she is 100% correct there. And by the way, again, we're not even talking about like they are rounding up thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of migrants who have broken immigration laws. Many of those people, as we've been talking about nonstop, are seeking asylum. They have not broken US law. They are here specifically abiding by US asylum law, and they're not allowed to actually pursue that, and they're being held against their will in these facilities. So she was attacked, including not just by random people on Twitter, but a Republican representative, Liz Cheney, who said, please AOC, do us all a favor and spend just a few minutes learning some actual history. 6 million Jews were exterminated in the Holocaust. You demean their memory and disgrace yourself with comments like this. So Liz Cheney is 100% wrong there, as has already been made clear at that point by AOC, the distinction between death camps and concentration camps, a distinction that is incredibly clear in the literature in this area. But Liz Cheney's comments brought condemnation from people who know better, including Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, who said, okay, internet, time to learn the difference between concentration camps and death or extermination camps. Germany started with concentration camps in 1933. Death camps started in 1941. Never again is now. And so people have attacked her and AOC for using that never again idea and saying, how dare you? How dare you compare this to that? But the whole point of saying never again about a thing is not to say if we find ourselves in literally the exact same situation, we'll do something about it. It's that we will learn from that historic example. We will learn from that massive historic tragedy, and we will not get to that point again. That is why concerns are being raised now as concentration camps and tent camps are being built at various parts across the southern border. And in fact, not even just at the border in the United States. We don't want to get to the point where the comparison makes itself. We want to stop it before we actually get there. And I just want to read one or two more quotes. One from Waitman Wade Bjorn, a Holocaust historian, who said, what's required is a little bit of demystification of it. Things can be concentration camps without being Dachau or Auschwitz. Concentration camps in general have always been designed at the most basic level to separate one group of people from another group. Usually because the majority group or the creators of the camp deem the people they're putting in it to be dangerous or undesirable in some way. That's what's happening now. It's everything to do with who those people are, not what they have done. If these were Canadians crossing the border to apply for asylum, they would not be held in concentration camps. It is only because they're coming from Central and Latin America and Southern America. That is the only reason that they're being held in these conditions. And in fact, in even more cruel conditions than what's described right there, because we already know that their policy is to scare people from coming across the border. Terror is baked into the DNA of the policy that we're seeing right now. And again, just one more quote from the Esquire piece, which by the way you should read, says, not every concentration camp is a death camp. In fact, their primary purpose is rarely extermination and never in the beginning. Often much of the death and suffering is a result of insufficient resources, overcrowding and deteriorating conditions. That is how so many people, by the way, died in Cuban concentration camps. It was not just because they were being killed, it was because they were being held in conditions where you could not help but die. And I don't want to get to the point where we need to fight back after finding out that 1,000 or 10,000 or 50,000 people have died in these concentration camps that already exist at the border. We need to be proactive before we get to that point. And so thank you to AOC for raising that issue now rather than when it's already too late. Okay, with that, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, an attempt to institute Medicare for All effectively in Texas. We'll give you the details after that.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
You must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The healthcare situation in Texas, as with many states, perhaps all states, is pretty rough at this point. With continued Republican leadership in certain areas, including women's reproductive rights, it's only getting worse recently. But there are attempts to rectify that situation, and we're going to be joined now by a guest to break down the Healthy Texas Act that aims to do massive improvement in that area. In Texas is Clayton Tucker, statewide coordinator in Texas for Our Revolution. Clayton, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. So describe for us the Healthy Texas Act. What is it about, and at what stage in the progress of this bill are we currently at?
So the Healthy Texas Act, or as we like to call it, Medicare for y'all, and y'all means all, is a it's a statewide single payer bill. It was crafted by the National Nurses United, and it does basically everything we need a healthcare system to do, at least on the state level, until we can get the real deal solution on the national level. So it covers pre-postnatal, it covers emergency transportation, and really just everything we need. Where we're at in the bill now, the Texas session has ended, which is both a blessing and a curse because they can't do any more damage, but we also can't get the bill to go any further this session. We did go pretty far this session. There are several bills like this throughout the states. There's California, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Iowa, Florida, and Texas. And so far, to my knowledge, Texas is one of the few, if not the only, that has gotten a hearing on the bill in committee. Now, what we are doing currently, because this is a long haul fight, we are going to county commissioners and county judges. We have calculated with the Center for Public Policy Priorities, a think tank here in Texas, about how much Medicare for y'all will save counties, the county budget, for instance. So, you know, a lot of roads are crumbling, a lot of bridges are crumbling, and a lot of schools are under finance. So we're going to county commissioners and county judges like, look, this will help y'all. And we got a really big endorsement just, I think last Wednesday, from the South Texas County Judge and County Commissioner Association, representing about 45 counties, both Democrat and Republicans, and they chose to unanimously endorse our Medicare for Y'all plan.
Okay, well, that's certainly good for the future of the bill. And really fast, if you could just remind me, I lived for quite a while in Texas, but I'm trying to remember, you said that the legislative session had just ended. They only serve for a small percentage of the time, correct?
Correct, it's about 60 to 90 days. That's the normal session, so basically the very start of the year till end of May, essentially.
Okay. Yeah, and the only really important business that government has to deal with is generally in the first quarter, so that should be fine. That's not an issue at all.
What could possibly go wrong?
But that gives you quite a bit of time to organize around the bill. I am curious, you mentioned how there's state level action like what you're pursuing and there's federal action. We've had a lot of conversation in the past year about Medicare for All as a possible nationwide plan. Has that conversation nationally helped your state level effort to get people in Texas to sign on to this plan?
Yes, well, as recent polling has showed, I believe it's 82% of Democrats, about two-thirds of Republican, two-thirds of independents, and about 50% of Republicans support Medicare for All. So that's one of the reasons we frame Healthy Texas as Medicare for Y'all, and we're pushing it at the state level to popularize it, and we do tie it very closely to the national legislation, and we kind of help each other, both the national and the state legislation kind of help each other, boost each other up.
Okay, so you've got polls there, and you've talked about going to different counties and talking to people there. In terms of actual legislators on the Democratic side and the Republican side, has there been much interest in pushing for this during the next session?
There is growing interest in this. So the bill was led by Representative Gina Hinojosa, a fabulous representative. And we also have, I believe there's three other co-sponsors for the bill this time around. Though we had a lot of people who were interested, but we couldn't get to commit this time around. Which is fine, we'll get them next time. And basically, we are going to be using this as a way to like, look, these representatives did or did not support, they were or were not supportive this time around. Healthcare is one of the most popular issues, at least in the state of Texas, I believe probably nationally so as well. Mm-hmm. So we're going to use this to push our representatives like, hey, if you want to be reelected, you really should focus on this and look how far we've come and look how popular these ideas are.
And you mentioned the money that could be saved for governments in the county level. I imagine overall in Texas it would be significant. But for individuals, if this plan were put into effect, what sort of economic impact would it have on people in Texas?
It would be pretty drastic in a very, very good way. So if I remember right, a lot of folks, well, let me actually use my I have a friend. I don't want to name them, but they voted for Trump. They are a Trump supporter, and they recently had a shotgun wedding, not because of pregnancy or anything like that, but because he had health insurance, she did not, and she's too sick to work, so she can't get health insurance, but then she can't work, all that kind of downward spiral. So I was telling them about Healthy Texas, and they're supportive of it. Because I was explaining to them is like, look what you're paying now. Chances are you're paying 25% of your income towards healthcare or through deductibles or through co-pays or premiums or whatever have you. We can eliminate all that. Mm-hmm. Also during the hearing we had, it was kind of advantageous for us. So we were supposed to be one of the first bills heard. We ended up being like the 10th, and all the bills before us or all the speakers before us were talking about how health insurance companies really royally screwed them over. So there was this lady who got cancer. She wanted some of her eggs to be frozen so she could have a child of her own later on. Health insurance didn't cover it.
Mm. And I'm imagining in some of those procedures, the bills would be quite high. Incredibly important in Texas, obviously a big state, very important politically for the future of the US. And so, best of luck in pushing for the bill and trying to get as much support for it as possible before the next session. Clayton Tucker of Our Revolution, Texas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, a couple more guests are gonna join us in studio after this. The future of an entire state might rest on a murder case from well over a century ago. This is not the sort of story that we normally talk about on the show, but it is fascinating. So I'm very excited to welcome in studio Rebecca Nagel, a journalist and host of Crooked Media's This Land podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so This Land, tell people the basic pitch of what story you're going to be telling about in the 8 episodes of the podcast.
Yeah, so This Land follows a Supreme Court case that has really high stakes. So what's at stake is the treaty territory of 5 tribes in Oklahoma and about half the land in the state. Mm-hmm. And it started actually with a murder in 1999. So a Creek citizen killed another Creek citizen and was sentenced to death by the state of Oklahoma. But then in his appeals, he argued that the state of Oklahoma didn't have jurisdiction to prosecute him because his crime happened on a reservation. Oklahoma says that reservation no longer exists. And so now that's the question that the Supreme Court is weighing. And it's gonna come out with a decision any day now, as early as Thursday.
And so that sort of defense, has that been used before?
You know, it sounds like it would be this really unusual circumstance, but it's not unusual for local governments and for state governments to not respect tribal territory or for there to be a conflict between what the tribe asserts is their land and what the state asserts is their land. And so, so this case, while it's really unique, we see that in Indian country a lot, where maybe like the local government or the state government doesn't respect the treaty territory of the tribe.
Okay. And so you talked about this topic or aspects of this topic back in 2018 in an op-ed at the Washington Post,
yeah,
which I was reading, which is again fascinating. For people who might not have read that, what's the basic idea of how much is at stake?
Yeah, so for me personally, my family members were treaty signers, and so they actually signed the treaty that brought my tribe to Oklahoma and is now part of the land that could be determined by this case. Mm-hmm. And so they were actually assassinated for signing that treaty, and so it's a family story that has been handed down to me. And so personally, what's at stake for me in this case is the sacrifice that my own family made. And so, if the Supreme Court rules and affirms not just Muscogee Creek Nation, but the reservations of all of the five tribes who are wrapped up in this case, it could be the largest restoration of native land in US history.
So before we turn to what it might look like if it was restored, let's talk about how it was originally taken, because you described that in your op-ed. And I could be getting the number wrong, but I think that you said that from the original point to now, how much of the land in terms of jurisdiction remains, it's 2%?
Yeah, so basically in the pathhood up to Oklahoma becoming a state, our tribes went through this process called allotment. Actually, over 100 tribes in the US went through allotment. It happened in the late 1800s, and basically tribes lost 2/3 of our land base during this time, but it's, you know, not covered in history books. But basically what the US government did is they came up, they divided up our communally owned tribal land and then assigned each little plot to an individual tribal citizen. But then after a while, they really wanted white people to be able to settle that land, so they allowed white people to come in and purchase it. But what ended up happening is that most of the land was taken, some by sale, but a lot by swindle and by cheating and by outright theft. And so after 100 years of the legal status quo that allotment set up, only 2% of that land within Cherokee Nation is still recognized by the state of Oklahoma as Indian country.
Yeah, that process was fascinating, that you basically remove the communal power and authority and make it up to individuals who can be more easily swindled out of their land.
Yeah, and we're targeted by really, you know, people could be assigned a white guardian who could lease or sell their land. You know, it could be taken over by squatters. The whole system was basically designed to give the land to individuals, but then to make it easy for white settlers to take.
Okay, so let's talk about the future. Is Oklahoma going to get cut in half? When will we know? And what is it looking like might happen?
Yeah, so I think it's important to say, like, you know, will the state of Oklahoma be cut in half? Like, what will happen if these reservations are affirmed? Is that, you know, reservations exist all over the country. And,
you know,
city governments and state governments in most of the states west of the Mississippi. And city states and state governments operate side by side reservations all the time. So like half the city of Tacoma is a reservation, you know, basically a suburb of Seattle, medium sized city. A third of the state of Arizona is reservation land. And those are places that function just fine. So the sky isn't gonna fall down. It's not gonna redrop the map of Oklahoma. Oklahoma will just be like other states that have reservations within their borders. And because tribes actually have very little jurisdiction over non-native people on our reservations, for non-native people living in Oklahoma, like not much in their day-to-day life is going to change. What it really does is protect the sovereignty of our tribes and really allows our tribes to maintain our self-governance and maintain our sovereignty over our land.
And so if this does happen, you described it as it would be the largest repossession of the land that was taken.
And I think it's important, our tribes, you know, our tribes say that our reservations were never disestablished by Congress. And so this has always been our reservation land, but Oklahoma doesn't recognize that. And so what the Supreme Court basically could do is make our state recognize what we've always known is true.
Yeah. And is there the possibility that this sort of situation could happen in other states?
Yeah, like I said, there are, you know, there was a really similar case that came out of Nebraska that was decided by the Supreme Court just 2 years ago. It was a smaller area of land, but it was a similar thing where the local government said, you know, this hasn't been the tribe's land for this long. They can exercise their jurisdiction here. This doesn't belong to them. And the Supreme Court said, actually, it does. And basically the same question that's being presented by this case. So it'll be really interesting now that we're talking about more land if they stick to the same principles.
Okay, and so for people who want to listen to the podcast, find out all that's happening, could you tell them about where they can find it? You're 3 episodes in now.
Yeah. If people want to catch up, they can find it at thislandpodcast.com or anywhere you get your podcasts. So Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, all those places.
Okay. Well, fascinating case. We're certainly going to be interested to see how it ends up going, and you can find out by listening to the podcast. Rebecca Nagle, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break here. We come back, Ken Klippenstein of TRT Investigates is going to be joining us. He had some really fascinating reporting on ICE hiding the deaths of people in its custody. We'll talk about that on the other side of this break. if you've been hearing news about people dying in ICE custody recently, and it has occurred to you to ask how many people are actually dying there. Turns out you could have found out up until a couple of years ago, but now it's a little bit more difficult. And joining us now to break it down is the man who broke the story, Ken Klippenstein. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hey, good to be with you again.
Good to have you here. So your most recent story actually has to do with a website that up until recently logged deaths in ICE custody. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so what's interesting is the deaths that they logged went all the way back to the founding of the institution of ICE. And I want to remind viewers that ICE is very young. It's not, like a lot of federal institutions we have going back to, you know, at least World War II. ICE was a post-9/11 institution founded in 2003 under George W. Bush, in largely in response to the attacks. And so the deaths that had been included on the list went all the way back to, that year, the year of the founding. And then it ends, the last death listed is in, I believe it was May of 2017. And of course, Trump was inaugurated a couple months before that. And that's when the listings end.
So interesting and perhaps not coincidental. Have ICE officials been forthcoming with why this list is no longer being updated?
Well, that's what was surprising me. It was such a simple question. I mean, I would expect at least some sort of boilerplate response, like, "Oh, maybe you can find it in the news or find it up in our." They didn't. They had no response. So your guess is as good as mine, unfortunately.
So I guess I'm curious. Would it be possible to use like a Freedom of Information Act request to find out if there had been emails? Like, were they directed to shut this down from outside of ICE? Would be my suspicion, but I don't know exactly how you'd go about finding that out.
Well, what's strange, the page itself doesn't even have an explanation. I do a lot of FOIA work and, I look at a lot of different agencies. And typically, when they stop doing a longstanding practice like that, maybe it's for nefarious reasons, but they'll at least offer some kind of like self-serving explanation. Mm-hmm. It was too time intensive or something. It just doesn't say anything. All it says is, it just has the last post and then it has a list of dates. It says data from blah, blah, blah to 2017 and just nothing.
So I want to get into how consequential this is. I mean, I know it would be easier to answer this question if the website was still being updated, but do we have any idea since the middle of 2017 how many people should be on that list but are not?
Well, what's interesting is they have another page now called, I think it's Death Reports, and that was mandated by Congress for them to put up. But these deaths begin in, I believe it was late 2018, and so that leaves a year, half of Trump's term so far that we have no data for. So, and also the criteria for these death reports they're posting appear to be different than the criteria in the original list. And again, no explanation for why they have this, other listing that is different innate. Why is it different? Why don't they just put it in the same thing they used to? But it's interesting that Congress, sort of forced them to put something up. And I have more reporting on this coming out later, but readers should know that that list is not the same as the other list, and that what I'm being told by sources within ICE is that list is pretty sanitized in terms of what it tells you.
Interesting, and actually that leads into my next question, because there's hiding information by not having a list, that certainly hides the information, but then there's also hiding the information by having information, but having it be vague so that you can't actually know exactly what's going on. So it appears, based on your story, that some of the cause of death in some of these instances is kept purposefully vague and could be hiding either negligence or even criminal behavior. Is that the case?
I mean, I'd say calling it purposely vague is even a little bit generous, because if you look at the explanation of the deaths for every other, for Bush and Obama, almost everyone had a, explanation of what exactly happened. For the majority of the cases under Trump, for the data that we have going up to mid-2017, it just still says pending. And these deaths are now what? That's 2 years ago. I mean, I imagine they figured out what happened. I hope so, at least. And it just says pending, no explanation about, when they're going to update that or if they ever will. But these cases that they haven't updated it for so long ago that I imagine it'll just stay like that forever.
I'm going to make a bold prediction that nobody's investigating those anymore. I don't think anyone's like punching in the clock today. Like today I crack that case. I don't think that's gonna happen. But again, on your previous work on preventable deaths and deaths due to negligence, there's been apparently some interest from some politicians. Have we found out anything more about this? Is anything going to be done to stop these sorts of deaths from happening?
More on that to come, but what I'm seeing is a lot of talk from Congress and from people in the inside ICE that I can't get too specific, but are trying to, bring about change on this. There's an enormous amount of frustration about Congress's, unwillingness to go beyond issuing statements about this.
I want to ask you one other question. I apologize, I didn't warn you that I'd be asking you about this, but you've been doing work on ICE. You know more about ICE than I do. Last night, Donald Trump announced that starting very, very soon, ICE would begin deporting literally millions of people. Based on what you know about ICE, its manpower, how it's deployed, all of that, is that a remotely feasible thing that he could do in the near future?
It is not. But it still caused her enormous concern because any kind of, I hate to use this term, but unfortunately, I think it's applicable. Any type of ethnic cleansing operation is always a logistical nightmare. So I don't think that means that we shouldn't worry about it, nor am I saying that you're saying that. But no, they don't have the resources now for it. But what that's going to mean is I fear it's going to be done in the, sloppiest, most inhumane way possible.
Yeah. And I also noted a little bit earlier in the show that tonight is going to be the formal launch of Trump's campaign effort. And we know that based on some of the moves his administration has taken recently, they're willing to do pretty much anything, including start a war possibly to get elected. So I have a feeling in the area of immigration, they're going to be pushing policies that you're going to need to be investigating in the near future. And if people have tips on any of these stories, how can they actually get in touch with you?
I would encourage them to reach out to me on Signal. That's a secure, encrypted platform that you can be relatively confident is not going to be able to be subpoenaed or snooped on from your employers. I list my phone number in my Twitter bio and also in my news articles. And then if you're not someone in ICE that needs that level of confidentiality, if you're, say, an attorney for an immigration attorney or, other maybe a rights activist, you can just contact me via my email, which is also listed on each of my articles.
Awesome. Well, Ken Klippenstein, TWT Investigates, thank you as always for the great work.
Great to be with you.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we're going to be closing out the show with Meanwhile In, big news from Canada, from Sudan, news from around the world after this. Here in America, things they're just falling apart. I don't know how much longer we're going to last, but we're not the only country in the world. And so we turn to Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in Hong Kong, massive protests continue. And when I say massive, I mean really, really, really massive. This tweet shows a picture. Take a look at this, that crowd. More than 25% of their population of 7.4 million people protested this weekend. By proportion, these are the largest protests in modern history. Absolutely stunning. And so, yes, by proportion, massive historically, obviously, but just in terms of getting millions of people together, not once, but multiple nights, going through multiple weeks, is an absolutely amazing effort that we have seen very, very rarely, even in populations that are much larger, like the effort against the Iraq war. There was the international climate protests. Like, to have that happen in one small area is truly amazing. And so I want to talk just a little bit about the progress there. There's a bill that we're going to give you the details of. The population is very worried about the implications. There has already been some progress with word that the bills, the push for the bill to be put out is currently suspended. The protesters are not satisfied with that and they want the bill to be shelved permanently. But let's talk about it. The suspended bill would have allowed Hong Kong officials to extradite wanted criminal suspects to stand trial in mainland China. The reason that's so controversial is that Hong Kong is meant to have a criminal justice system that's independent from China. Critics of the law fear that the extradition law would be abused by Chinese authorities to suppress political dissent and would dramatically curb Hong Kong's autonomy from the mainland. And so the reason that's important, I might get the date wrong, but there's effectively supposed to be a different system in Hong Kong until I think 2047, where they have much more autonomy in exactly these sorts of areas. And while the actual letter of the law seems limited, specifically, the worry is that it could be widened and political dissidents and things like that could start to fall under its sway. Let's talk a little bit more about the protest that's getting the progress that it already has. Estimates of turnout on this is last Sunday range from hundreds of thousands to over a million. If the number of protesters did in fact exceed a million, that would mean that this Sunday's protest was roughly as large as the first major protest against the bill last Sunday, which is a show not only of the passion behind this effort, but its durability and its stability as well. There's some great, if you take a look at the past couple of days, there's this viral video of the crowd parting in amazing fashion for an EMS vehicle that was moving through the area. And one protester tragically died while hanging a flag, and the memorials, the sort of organic memorials for that individual and the protests as they continue have been really inspiring as well. Meanwhile, in Canada, caravans of Americans have been arriving to buy medicine. There's a woman, Alicia Greenseed, who led a small caravan last month to the town of Fort Francis in Ontario, where she and five other Americans paid about $1,200 for drugs. This is insulin. It would have cost them $1,200 in the United States. Quinn Nystrom, who's a type 1 diabetic, said, "It felt like we were robbing the pharmacy. It's been years since I had 10 vials in my hands." There's been a lot of coverage in the past year or so about the rising cost of insulin and how it is just breaking people's backs. Again, if you need insulin, you need insulin. This is not some sort of optional thing that you can just choose to go with some alternative. It is necessary, and that is why it is so horrendous that the pharmaceutical companies are gouging people for life-saving medicine. To give you an idea of how the price has been going up, let's take a look at this chart going back to 2012. The average cost of insulin to treat type 1 diabetics for a patient in the US for a year nearly doubled between 2012 and 2016. Paying $3,000 for insulin back in 2012 was not a cool situation to be in, having to pay almost $6,000 a couple of years ago, even worse. And we know that the situation has been worse since then. We don't have the specific information there, but the per vial cost of insulin has been going up. It's why that first caravan happened. And by the way, they're planning to do future caravans. If this situation continues, you can expect that more and more people will be doing this, traveling to Canada for medicine that has no reason to be so much cheaper there than it is in the US, other than the greed of the pharmaceutical companies and the willingness of politicians to continue a broken system. Meanwhile, in Sudan, the situation is growing even more tense and violent and dangerous than it was previously. And we're talking about a situation that has already claimed the lives of well over 100 people, regardless of who you talk to, unless you talk to the government, because they apparently are lying about how many people have actually been killed. The situation is complex and goes back a long time in the Sudan. I am no expert of it, although we have reached out to experts to join us on the show. But there is progress in the situation that I want to at least briefly cover. And that is that protest leaders just yesterday said that they had begun a revolutionary escalation to pressure the Transitional Military Council to hand over power to civilians and condemn the crackdown on a sit-in camp earlier this month. Protest leaders have called for nighttime demonstrations and marches in the capital of Khartoum and elsewhere in the country. So effectively, you had a longtime autocrat who was eventually ousted. That seemed like a good development, but the actual process of the transition has been taken over by the military. People living in that country incredibly worried about what that could result in. And if you've looked at military transitions of power in the past half century or so, it generally doesn't end very well. So I understand their concern. That has led to massive protests that have unfortunately led to the deaths of many people involved in those protests. Thousands of demonstrators who had camped outside the army headquarters in the capital for weeks were violently dispersed by gunmen and military fatigues back on June 3rd, leaving dozens dead and hundreds wounded, according to doctors and witnesses. And so far, to give you an idea of how horrendous this crackdown on peaceful protesters has been, at least 128 people have been killed since the June 3rd crackdown, the majority on that day, but again, many people since then. This is according to doctors linked to the protest movement. So Gunmen apparently affiliated with that movement were dispatched to attack these protesters. By the way, afterward, scores of bodies were found dumped in the Nile following the crackdown. So not only were these people gunned down, but an effort was made to hide the evidence by dumping in incredibly callous fashion the bodies of literally dozens and dozens of people into a river that had to then be found. So we're gonna continue to watch the situation. We're gonna try to bring in some people who are experts on Sudanese politics and reporting in the very near future, but a very dangerous situation that could become violent once again in the near future. So with that, that's unfortunately all the time that we have. Thank you to everybody who's been leaving reviews. We'll read some in future episodes. Thank you for watching. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.